Now, as I looked at the last speech, what I heard was a representative of what I call the positive extrapolists. Extrapolists are people who say that things will go on into the future in essentially unchanged ways. That was a continuing theme right through the speech. This is what has happened for the last 40, 60, 80, 100 years. And therefore, we can expect those things to continue to happen. It is one predominant type of thinking about the future. It is also argued that this is, by this group of people, that what it has happened and will happen is, in general, good, desirable, satisfactory, and hopeful. Now, the question is not, you see, whether that future is possible, because I suspect that we could, for X number of years into the future, continue to push for greater wealth, for a less dignified distribution of income, for less people working, and the system would survive, at least for a time. And one of the latest books to come out is from a gentleman called Herman Kahn, who is the head of the positive extrapolists, if you can think of a head for a movement, in which he has resuscitated the trickle-down notion. It says it's all right to be rich, both as people and as nations, because that's the way the poor eventually get rich. And I see us as being terribly willing at the moment to rebuy that theory. It's a lovely theory. It's a particularly lovely theory for Minnesota, because you're going to do very nicely out of this new world that's developing. Because the previous speaker is indeed quite right. Agriculture is one of the power structures of our society. It's where a lot of the wealth is going to come from. And if you can kid yourselves into saying, okay, we're entitled to everything we can grab off it, and if the United States can kid itself into saying that we are entitled to blackmail other countries with our food, we're not far from that, then we can have a very good life. Now, whether we can survive over the long haul is another question. You see, there is the thing that is necessary to make this theory work is something that I cannot believe. And that is that the poor countries are simply going to wait around being hungry and hungrier and starving and die. We have a neat new theory which is called sometimes triage from the battlefield theory, that you look after the least wounded first and you say that the most wounded you don't worry about. Sometimes called lifeboat ethics, which is another theory which says there isn't enough room in the lifeboat, so we'll have to throw some people out. Interestingly, it's never us, it's them. Now, the question is why they should let us do it to them. If you think that the United States is invulnerable to terrorist attack, you're crazy. If you think that terrorists will allow us to live well for even a limited period into the future, I think you are wrong. I'm not sure, but I think you are wrong. I think our only hope is to learn how to share. Now, by that, I do not mean foreign aid. The people who argue against foreign aid are right. We've done at least as much harm as we have good with foreign aid. Charity has always been a neat way for the giver to feel good about giving things away to the person who receives, at least nearly always. There are very few of us who know how to give money without making people feel bad and demean by getting it. And that's how we've used foreign aid. But the other end of the scale cannot be right either, the statement that we are entitled to have large numbers of people starving in the rest of the world. How do we do it? So that's one vision of the future. I can't buy it. Now, there's a second vision of the future, and they also are extrapolous, but it's very interesting. They take the same world, and instead of saying things are getting better, they say things are getting worse. And when you get a positive and a negative extrapolist together in the same room, which happened at a recent conference in Houston, and they try to sit down and explain how they take the same world and make totally different realities out of it, it is a fascinating experience. It doesn't explain anything, regrettably, because they can't do it, because the way they see the world has nothing to do with each other. And I'll come back to that at the end, because in a sense it's the most critical point that I can raise. The negative extrapolists have been a group called the Club of Rome. They have become, I think, the people who would stop nuclear construction. And we're concentrating a great deal of our negative extrapolist thinking around we cannot afford nuclear power. And we've done something very neat, which is to say nuclear power is more dangerous than anything else that we have around. If you look, for example, at the number of chemical compounds we have around and the potential danger they pose, it is probably far higher. Certainly, if you look at the danger of misapplied genetic engineering, which we are not far enough away from to be comfortable with, the dangers are much higher. I think we have to look at the total range of what is happening to us because of science, and to recognize, and I'll come back to this theme, that we cannot run this world any longer without some old values. The values of honesty, responsibility, humility, and love, and a respect for mystery. And that those values, which we have tended to sort of say, well, they're groovy things to talk about on Sundays so we can go out for the rest of the week and do the things we want to do, it isn't enough. It is not enough to go to church in order to feel good about being immoral, gouging, and a number of other things. And yet, all too often, the church has become the support system for the person to be able to say, well, I'd really like to be a nice person, but it isn't possible in today's world, so yes, I will pay my dues for an hour on Sunday. I may even give some money. See, money is, in a sense, the easiest thing in the world today, both to make and to give away. That's quite true. If you want to make a million and you don't, it proves you're incompetent. It's all it proves. Very serious. Making money is not difficult if you are willing to pay the cost for making money. I happen to think that it's too destructive. But that's part of my value set, and I'll come to that in a minute. Now, the third vision is what I call the romantic vision. It's a vision that is more powerful than we think it is. It's a vision that if we all became nice people tomorrow morning, the world would be a great place to live in, and that that is a feasible way of thinking. Now, if we all became nice people tomorrow morning, it's probably true that the world would be a nice place. Well, the problem is we haven't done it yet. And while I think we overplay the line of original sin, my statement to clergy who sort of overpush that is always, I wish they'd worry about their own and not push it onto other people, is that a social system that does not admit the possibility of sin, error, and failure isn't going to work terribly well. And that, of course, is what the Founding Fathers were about in 1776. And it tells us a lot about what sort of social design might work in 1976 if we hadn't all got into a mood of Pollyanna optimism in conjunction with both the election and the bicentennial, in which we apparently have decided that everything is going to work out. I mean, if anybody can give me any evidence for that statement, I'd be delighted. But to argue that a culture which has failed to make decisions on energy, ecology, and economic growth for the past 4 years, or where it has made them in totally contradictory ways, so that you're meant to buy a car to get economic growth, you are not to run it because that uses gasoline, but if you should run it, you must have a catalytic converter. And when you realize that that isn't only true of cars, but it's true of industry and agriculture and everything else, if we have failed for the past 4 years to make good decisions, it's a little difficult to me to see why suddenly we are going to become good decision makers. Those of you who have been near Congress realize that even if you are a good and caring congressperson, that system is so set up so that good decision making is inconceivable. In fact, honest Congress people will now tell you that the best they hope for is to avoid falling over their feet either physically or mentally during the course of the day. By the way, the other thing that would happen if we became nice people tomorrow morning is we would have the worst recession that has ever happened. And one of the questions that I keep on asking myself is the degree to which the last recession happened because we changed our lifestyles. I asked a group of people, United Methodists in Wisconsin, how many people had begun to change their lifestyle. And I was startled to see it was well over half. There is a poll out that says that 51% of the American people feel that they have begun to change their lifestyle. I think it is much more dramatic and much further along than we realize. But an economic growth system that depends on forced consumption cannot work if people decide that they don't need everything that the system is capable of turning out. So my belief is that we are in a different, fundamentally different position to the one out of which we think and analyze. In fact, for those of you who know a little bit about religious history, I'd like to suggest to you that what we have done is simply raise the old religious heresies to the point of social fallacies. That predestination, the idea that God decided whether or not you went to heaven, is only the personal level of social extrapolation, which says, it doesn't matter what you do, it's going to happen anyway. If that's true, what on earth are we doing wasting a beautiful day out there for? I mean, if it doesn't matter what we do or think or say, we're all wasting our time. I find it very difficult to understand the justification for that. I mean, if things are going to get better, why not let them get better? If things are going to get worse, why don't we enjoy it until the Holocaust comes? I mean, I can't see any fun of sort of leaning out of the window when we go over the cliff and saying, I tried, really? The other end, it says, look, there's really no difficulty in bringing about social change. It was the free will model now raised to the social level. All I have to do is to change my way of living and the society is going to work and that's all we got to do. Well, I've never found a social or a personal or an institutional innovation that hasn't taken more work, guts, effort, leadership than I like to think about. You know, I've never seen a good idea just come, sort of walk through an organization. Somehow good ideas always seem bad when they're originally introduced. And so I come to what I call a leadership model, or a management model, if you don't mind that word management, because it's a good word to me, not a bad one. And I start from the assumption that we are stuck with the problem of managing the earth. And there are very many moments when I wish we hadn't got there. Because it was so much nicer when most of the decisions were made by, and people use different words, God, nature, you know, whatever you like. But it wasn't us. We didn't have anything to do with it. And so you could say, I'll plow the field. It won't make any difference. When you plow one field, it doesn't. When you plow all of the fields wrong in Colorado in the 1930s and you get the wrong pattern of rainfall, it makes all the difference in the world. And so you come to one of the major issues that's affecting this state. Is there a new climate pattern developing? Some very competent climatologists who argue that we have moved into a different climate stage. We have had 30 years of incredibly good climates and that we must now expect things to get steadily worse. Now, depending on whether they're right or not, you have a totally different management problem for Minnesota, the United States, and the world. In one case, the food problem is a manageable problem. In the other case, the food problem is an acute problem which, unless handled well, will swamp us in the immediate future. And how do you answer that sort of question? We don't even begin to know the tools to know whether or not a climate shift is taking place. Take a different one, which all of you have heard about. What about this aerosol issue? The aerosol statement, which says we shouldn't use aerosols because it will cause a destruction of part of the atmosphere which will increase skin cancer. But you see, as somebody once said, everything is a carcinogen. In other words, everything causes cancer. Now that may not quite be true, but it's very close to true. And yet we have a law which says that if you can prove that drinking anything to any level would lead you to have cancer, it must be banned. If you look, for example, at some of the soft drink additives that have been banned, it's been calculated that you need to drink about 40 bottles a day for 30 years in order to get cancer from it. Well, I think it's improbable. My guess is there are more dangerous things you can do than drink 40 bottles of pop for 30 days a year. And it's that sort of problem that we are now in the dilemma of dealing with, and which Washington, and indeed government in general, is probably not capable of dealing with at all. That the assumption that a group of people can make laws and regulations and apply them and take away from us as individuals, as localities, and as states the rights to make our own decision is not a viable way of thinking anymore. You know, we say that all the time. We say there's going to be a decentralization of power. We say that we're going to have more local decision-making, and nobody ever says, well, how on earth do you sort out the consequent mess? I mean, have any of you thought about the process of de-legalifying, deregularizing the United States and saying, yes, it is all right for Crookston to make decisions about its own future? Remembering that the reason we got into this whole direction was the feeling that we were not gutsy enough, tough enough, responsible enough to look after the people who weren't in the majority. Why did we get into busing? Why did we get into all sorts of social innovation? Because we felt that the local community was so selfish, so irresponsible, that if it were left to itself, it would never do anything but look after its own central core majority, and the minority could go to hell. And so you see, I come back to that central thesis of mine that the human race either grows up either begins to care, first of all, each individual about themselves, and then about the people they relate to, or we don't make it. Well, that's, I think, a very different rhetoric to the one with which we are trying to solve our problems. There are a couple of things that I want to put in front of you. First of all, let's look at some policy issues. Let's look, first of all, at full employment. Senator Humphrey has been trying to push a thing called the Humphrey-Hawkins Bill. The Humphrey-Hawkins Bill, in its drive, is a statement that everybody should have a job, and that in order to make that happen, there must be government planning. If any of you care at all about freedom and free enterprise, the Humphrey-Hawkins Bill is the most disastrous idea that has yet been promulgated in terms of destroying the freedom of this culture and people in it to make their own decisions. The only alternative that I see, if one is to be real at all, is to say that we must come up with new options for providing people with incomes, which means a thing which is anathema to many people in this state, a guaranteed income. An option which allows the individual to operate as an institution, to be free enough, and it's an old Jeffersonian idea. He said nobody could be free without land. We can't give everybody land anymore. The equivalent is an income of some sort. In the area of health, we are all head up about a national health insurance scheme. I think that is as dangerous as the Humphrey-Hawkins Bill, because it will freeze us into a sickness system. You know, have you ever wondered why when you go to hospital you should not know what your temperature is? Why, if you sort of crawl down to the end of the bed and try and pick your chart up and the nurse sees you at it, she sort of screams her head off? Because you are incompetent. Because you are not entitled to take care of yourself, because we run a sickness system in this culture. And until we learn to run a health system in this culture, until we learn to say that the primary job is to keep people well so that they don't go to hospital and don't go to doctors, we will continue to have this problem. A national health insurance scheme will lock us into a system which says that people are incompetent to look after themselves. And until that changes, we're not going to do anything about the health system, which leads us to a very messy, untidy, an ugly question, which is the one that lies beyond the right to life, and it's the right to death. When can people die? When should people die? The argument that you wait for God's will is, of course, not a reasonable argument, because the problem is the technology has already taken away from God's will in the way that that was meant. An awful lot of old people, you know, the argument I get when I talk about this is people say to me, oh, but Bob, you won't feel this way when you get older. And yet the most surprising thing to me now is the number of older people who say that the right we need most urgently is a right to death. It came out in a meeting in Spokane when we had a group of older people together, and the first thing they said was, look, we must have a right to die. How do you manage it? And in this book I did called Beyond Despair, the one change I made after I'd finished it was because of the Quinlan case. Because it's quite clear we can't wait any longer for that right. And yet we're not adult enough to do it, because there are an awful lot of kids who would hurry their grandparents on with the line, dear, don't you think you really have lived long enough? I mean, any of you who've been around wills at all know just how ugly that whole scene can get. And I'm going to tread on toes now. I have to talk about the right to life. I think abortions are disastrous. But I think that anybody who says that and does not go on to say that that means the need and the availability of birth control for everybody, effectively, is not being reasonable. And I think that unless we become less emotional and less ugly about this issue, it is one of the issues that can tear apart our capacity to talk to and through this set of issues. It is not realistic to argue that people are going to abstain from sex unless they're going to have kids. What we do at the moment is we look after the middle class. Why are there less pregnancies among the middle class than among the poor? Not because the middle class engage less in sex outside marriage. I hope I'm not breaking any tremendous mythology around here. I suspect you know this. But if we don't want abortions, then we'd better make sure that people don't have unwanted pregnancies, and we better stop burying our heads in the sand. Justice. We don't have a justice system. We have two justice systems. We have one for the underprivileged and one for the privileged. Now, for the privileged, we say that they have suffered enough, a rhetoric which you may remember. It turned up at Watergate rather frequently. And there was one person who I thought did particularly well. He came to the judge and he said, "My daughter and my wife need me." The judge said, "Please go home and look after them." I did want somebody from a ghetto to turn up the next day to the same judge and say, "My wife and my children need me," and I have a horrible feeling he wouldn't have got the same answer. The rich and the powerful, we believe in redemption. The poor, we believe in punishment. And we are now saying, let's get everybody into jail. There's only one problem, and it's a very interesting problem. There was a sort of unconsciously funny Washington State report where he said, "We'd love to put more people into jails, but there aren't any. So unless you're willing to pay for them, what are we going to do?" And nobody saw that it's very black humor, but it's certainly humor. Alabama is under court order to clean up its federal prisons, and there's no way it can do it because they're overcrowded. Justice, it seems to me, requires primarily that we keep our kids out of the criminal culture. Because once they get in, the criminal system will create criminals with an 80% success rate. And we won't pay the cost of keeping our kids out, and we won't look at how difficult it is for kids to grow up without coming in contact with the law. It's less of a problem in the rural area. It's more and more of a problem in the city. The things I was able to do when I was growing up and what kids can do now are much less. How do kids test themselves? There isn't much space left in our culture. And if they test themselves in the wrong way, they suddenly find themselves in jail. Education. Education, we have got ourselves, well, moments when I think that education is an example of our drive for more. We started off and said everybody should be able to read, write, and figure, and that would take a couple of years. Then we said if 2 years of education are good, then 4 must be better. And then somebody said, well, if 4 years of education are good, then 8 years must be better. And somebody said, if 8 years are good, then 16 years must be better. And somebody was about to say, if 16 years are good, then 32 years must be better. And somebody said, well, look, no, hold it. I mean, look, there's a little problem with that one. Schools are reality poor. The classic McLuhan story, the kids walking down the street identifying the planes as they fly overhead. And as they come to the schoolroom door, one says to the other, now let's go in and string those darn beads. Education is primarily stringing darn beads. How many of your kids are challenged? And I've just realized just how serious this is, because your kid comes home in the evening and he or she says, "Mom, Dad, school was terrible today." And you've had a hard day at the office or at the stove. And you say, "Dear, don't bother me now. When you grow up, you'll understand." Now, that doesn't sound too bad until you realize what you've actually done. What you've actually done is to say to that child, "You are not even competent to evaluate that one experience you have, which is your school." If they can't even evaluate that, what's left but to go out and drink and take drugs and to engage in sex and to have a good time? Because you obviously can't even make sense of your own world. And then we're surprised. It's not very reasonable. So, in my opinion, we have to change four fundamental operating principles in the United States. Number one, we have to give up on the idea that more is always better than less and will make us happy. There's a hell of a lot of evidence that people don't get happier with more. Yeah, I know that suffering on a sod farm in Oklahoma isn't any good. But suffering in a split level isn't much better. And to say that people don't suffer in a split level is to deny the possibility of frustration of the rich and the middle class, and it is a peculiarly arrogant and ugly form of cultural deception. Money does not make for happiness, and to argue that you can be happier with money than without it, I mean you are less unhappy, is to me an inadequate argument. We are going to have to learn to live with the idea of enough. Now, please note that there is something wonderful about the idea of enough, because I cannot set it for you and you cannot set it for me. I cannot say to you, you're a woman, you have a wife, you know, a husband, three kids, a cat and a dog, and therefore you're entitled to 12.9 energy units. Because nobody knows enough about other people's needs, all we can do is set our own needs. But we can say we don't need more than we need. Not everybody needs a snowmobile. You might even share. It's a terribly non-American idea. Number two, we must get away from the idea that people can be equal. If you think about equality, you will eventually and inevitably end up in the Orwellian hole of some people are more equal than others. There's no way out. We must believe in diversity, which is a different statement. Each of us are of value, but we are of value for our uniqueness and not because I am equal to you. And the job is to find a place where each person out of that uniqueness and concern can do good work, develop themselves fully. That's a much tougher and much more difficult job than equal opportunity. It's my opinion that equal opportunity is serving as a technique by which we hire male women, old young people, and white blacks. That what we are doing is reducing the reality of diversity in systems, because we say, "Oh, look, there are 12 women in this office now." And if anybody says, "But they behave exactly the same as white males," people say that isn't a fair comment. But what we're trying to do, if I'm right at all, is to change the whole way that we organize our culture. Number three, we must get away from the idea of control. The classic one is the cat that always clawed the curtains. And the man was terribly house proud, and therefore he didn't like that, so every time the curtains got clawed, he threw the cat out. The cat rapidly learned that the way to get out was to claw the curtains. how many of our control systems have been distorted in that way? There are two colleges in Oklahoma City, one of which is a totally closed and efficient library. The other one is a totally open library, and it is very strange that the open library loses less books than the closed library. Cheating the system is a challenge that people cannot resist. On the other hand, if there isn't a system to cheat, there isn't much fun in cheating it, is there? The fourth requirement is the one I alluded to, that we cannot survive without the reintroduction of the religious values. Honesty, responsibility, humility, love, and a respect for mystery. Now, the problem is terribly simple. There are at least four different ways that you can look at your future. You can say, yes, we can go on, we can get bigger farms, we can expect more wealth, everything can continue, and things can get better. In that case, you do one set of things with your life because your self-interest is in a particular direction. You can believe that things will get inevitably and rapidly worse, in which case you will do another thing with your life. You can believe that it is adequate to be groovy people with each other, in which case you will do yet a third thing with your life. Or you can believe, as I do, that we have to learn to manage the earth. Deciding on those options is the task we have to do. And all of us are essentially booby-trapped by our past. The thing I have done most of for the past 10 years is to try to change the criteria of success by which I live. To make it very specific, I have learned that being well-known, in the sense of being known by the media, is in itself destructive of your capacity to communicate. In other words, if you knew who I was before I came here, you wouldn't have listened. If it had been Ralph Nader talking, you know what he is going to say, so you come to either get high on him or to really hate his guts. But you don't come to listen. And that, to me, is what this is all about, because we can either think of each other in terms of you and I disagree and I'm going to fight you, or we can think of each other in terms of you and I have different opinions and can learn from each other. Now, our culture teaches us that if you and I disagree, one of us is wrong. So we get into a fast and rapid argument in which we are very good at disagreeing because we learn all the skills of how to disagree, and sooner or later we get into a total deadlock. At that point, we move to City Hall. And in order to make sure that we get it passed by City Hall, we wait until our opponents are out of town and we get the measure through. That's one vision of the world. The people who disagree with you are to be bullied, coerced, manipulated to do what you know is right. That is, at best, what I call a win-lose universe, and all too easily disintegrates into a lose-lose universe. It comes out of our way of thinking about the world, which believes that there is one objective truth, and if somebody doesn't agree with you, one of us has to be wrong. Now, if that isn't the way the universe works, then we better go in a new direction. There is no objective truth. I'm sorry, Fred. Social science is based on a totally obsolete method of thinking. What we learn in sociology, political science, economics, most of anthropology, statistics, and I can go on, is based on Newtonian physical science, which some of you may remember was proved to be a special case rather early in the 20th century. Are you going to allow yourselves to get caught up in the hatreds and the tensions of the big cities, which exist particularly on the East Coast, and I've just had a meeting where we've had that, where there's no trust left, where you cannot talk? Or are you going to take that remaining trust you have and begin to develop institutional structures which are based on your capacity for trust? See, our institutional structures at the present time are based on the assumption we can't trust each other, therefore we must have checks and balances and all of that jazz. What we need is some institutional structures which say that the checks and balances which we do need come from our own personal leadership, discussion, disagreement, agreement, and learning. And I'd like to argue, and I've argued this again and again, that Minnesota, and if you like, the upper Midwest states, should get into what I call value decision making and should begin to develop some institutional bases for learning how you make non-coercive decisions. And that it's got to be done somewhere, and it certainly isn't going to be done on the East Coast. And that if it isn't done anywhere at all, we are going to watch ourselves fall into 1984, Brave New World, or whatever your dystopia that you most dislike is. See, I either believe that we will move towards a more human society in the immediate future, or a much less human society. And it's people like us who are going to determine which it is. Meetings like this are not groovy exercises for me. They're opportunities for us to decide whether or not we want to be change agents. Change agents don't have to be hated, by the way. They tend to be disruptive, but being hated is not terribly useful. How are you a change agent in a way that allows people to learn with you rather than against you, is one of the questions.